It's 8:59 and Press Watch is up next. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Report from Kabul speech by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. Zahair Wahab, a native of Afghanistan and director of graduate studies at the American University of Afghanistan, will present a critical analysis of the Afghani political, military, economic, and cultural situation. Again, that's a report from Kabul by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good morning, this is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Oregon's Land Use Board of Appeals yesterday unanimously rejected Portland's limits on the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure in the city, saying the ordinance violated the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. That's from an article in OregonLive.com by Ted Sickinger. And Sickinger writes, the ordinance was passed last December and was the signature legacy of Portland Mayor Charlie Hale. So remember that? We all got together, went down to the city council, and by golly, Portland was going to stand up against the fossil fuel industry, and the city decided against making zoning changes to accommodate a $500 million propane export terminal, while apparently the Canadian energy company Pembina Pipeline Corporation went to the Land Use Board of Appeals, a three-member appointed group, and the city is considering an appeal to the State Court of Appeals. Mayor Ted Wheeler said the decision was disappointing, and a few other things. So you can find that article on OregonLive.com. Looked up the members of the land board, and they are Todd Bassam, Michael Holston, and Melissa Ryan. And from what I could find out just from a quick look, Todd Bassam is lives in Salem, it would appear. Also is a member of the Small Yacht Sailing Club of Oregon, and I guess has a small yacht. These are all three attorneys. Michael Holston, the chair of the board, seems to live in Portland, was previously an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice, and Melissa Ryan also seems to live in Portland, or was in private practice with a firm in Portland in any case, Dunn Carney. So Todd Bassam, Michael Holston, and Melissa Ryan have thwarted Portland's attempt to move against global warming. So here's some more global warming news. This from thinkprogress.org. Normally, the hottest years on record occur when the underlying human-caused global warming trend gets a temporary boost from an El Niño, enhanced warming in the tropical Pacific. This is an article by Joe Rahm, who founded Think Progress. thinkprogress.org. And he writes, so it's been a surprise to climate scientists that 2017 has been so remarkably warm because the last El Niño ended a year ago. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported Tuesday that the first half of 2017 was the second warmest January to June on record for Earth, topped only by 2016, which was boosted by one of the biggest El Niños on record. Quoting leading climatologist Michael Mann, in an email to Think Progress, as if it wasn't shocking enough to see three consecutive record-breaking years in 2014, 15, and 16, for the first time on record, we're now seeing near-record temperatures even in the absence of the El Niño assist that previous record years benefited from, end quote. Well, I have several topics to bring up here today on Press Watch. A lot of the news you're not supposed to know. And I invite your calls and comments, 503-231-8187. From The Guardian in the UK, a bill that would repeal major pieces of the Affordable Care Act without replacing it would increase the number of people without insurance by 32 million people over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The analysis came as Donald Trump urged Republicans to move away from a plan to repeal the 2010 health care law with a delayed replacement, a move that he had previously supported and one that comes with considerable political risks. The legislation, a revised version of the bill that a majority of Senate Republicans voted for in 2015 and Barack Obama vetoed, was expected to come up for a vote early next week, even though it lacked enough support to pass. At least three senators, and by that I think they mean three senators on the Republican side, have said that it would be irresponsible to repeal major parts of the law without replacing them. So impinging on that is the fact that Senator McCain has a brain tumor, and it's the sort of brain tumor that quite likely will kill him. And I'm interested to know what you think about that, because Al Gore is in the news. Al Gore was on Facebook Live with Bernie Sanders this morning, and he used to say that he was reluctantly in favor of single-payer health insurance, but now he seems to be enthusiastically in favor of it, and Sanders and Gore are now saying that now is the time to press for single-payer, and actually Trump seems to be frightened of it because he brought it up by name. Which is kind of a major mistake in the propaganda playbook. He talked down single player and said that it would be impossibly expensive, which is the opposite of the truth, actually. So if you want to call and comment on that, 503-231-8187. Interested in hearing from those of you who would be cut off and who would be sentenced to death by a repeal of the Affordable Care Act without a replacement. Moving on, news items, emails released by Donald Trump Jr. last week, just before they were published by the New York Times, make it clear that the Trump camp, at the very least, attempted to collude with the Russian government during last year's presidential campaign. Cue complete crazy from the Russia-obsessed liberal media. This is from redflag.org.au, and it's just what it sounds like. Some commie commentary, and I was glad to find it because I quite agree with this article. They write, MSNBC host Rachel Maddow described it as proof of maybe the biggest American political scandal ever. According to liberal journalist Jared Yates Sexton, the Trump Jr. emails revealed, quote, the dumbest and biggest crime in the history of American politics. There's not even a close second, end quote. Left-wing writer Corey Robin tried to help Sexton out with a quick list of things that are big crimes in the history of American politics. Quote, slavery, Jim Crow, Indian extermination, Japanese internment, Hiroshima, overthrow of Arbenz, overthrow of Allende, support for Salvadoran death squads, support for Guatemalan genocide, bombing of Cambodia, end quote. Robin's list was excellent, but it didn't get up to some of the more recent crimes like wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, house foreclosures, the poisoning of Detroit's water, the obscene wealth of the 1%, police murders, mass incarceration, drone strikes, and the surveillance state. To liberals, though, these are dicey topics, subjects occasionally worth giving lip service to, but fundamentally dangerous and open to a radical interpretation that puts blame for the hardships facing the American people as much on the Democrats as on Republicans. Much better to talk about Russia. And they write, the Trump-Russia connection is an opportunity to attack Trump and the GOP from the right, to demolish their patriotism, to invert Cold War McCarthyism and turn its rhetoric into a tool of the anti-GOP liberal propaganda. But more than that, it is an opportunity to derail the real resistance to Trump, to divert the anger of the millions who hate his agenda and want a real fight back into the Democratic Party electoralism. That is not to say that the Trump-Russia connection is not extraordinary or worthy of investigation. Hostility to Russia is built into the DNA of the post-war U.S. ruling class. The decades of the Cold War made hating, not just communism in general, but Russia in particular, a national obsession. The extent of collaboration between the Trump campaign and the Russian government is yet to be determined, but Trump's link with elements of the Russian mafia state are undeniable. A remarkable piece by Craig Unger in the New Republic pointed out, over the past three decades, at least 13 people with known or alleged links to Russian mobsters or oligarchs have owned, lived in, and even run criminal activities out of Trump Tower and other Trump properties. According to Unger's report, quote, many used his apartments and casinos to launder untold millions in dirty money. Some ran a worldwide high-stakes gambling ring out of Trump Tower in a unit directly below one owned by Trump. Others provided Trump with lucrative branding deals that required no investment on his part. Taken together, the flow of money from Russia provided Trump with critical infusion of financing that helped rescue his empire from ruin, burnish his image, and launch his career in television and politics, end quote. These things are just one more thing. These links are just one more thing that make the fact that Trump rose all the way to the presidency extraordinary. There is great hypocrisy, they write. Of course, the U.S. liberal establishment that complains about interference in its democratic processes is, insofar as it represents the U.S. political system as a whole, responsible for more foreign incursions in other countries' democratic processes than any other entity in human history, from CIA-backed democratic movements, and that's a quote, air quotes if you like, to enforced regime change at the hands of U.S. military. There is not a power in history that has exerted more influence over other people's modes of governance than the U.S. state. But none of that bothers the ruling elite. Trump's crime, they write, as charged by the New York Times and the Washington Post, is not a crime against democracy in general or even against American people, but against the American empire. It's that crime that they consider unforgivable. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Now, there's a couple of topics I want to turn to today. One is Venezuela, and the other is the situation that has arisen with the attempt to suppress free speech over the boycott and divestment movement. Electronic Intifada writes, U.S. Senator Ben Cardin is once again trying to pass legislation designed to suppress the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights. And speaking for myself, this includes Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. He has signed on. Skipping ahead in the article, Senator Cardin introduced the Israel Anti-Boycott Act on the 23rd of March, designed to coincide with the annual policy conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The powerful Israel lobby group duly made the bill one of its top legislative priorities. The Senate version of the bill, S-720, has several co-sponsors, Republican and Democrats, and as I said, that includes Ron Wyden. And pardon me just a moment. Its counterpart in the House, H.R. 1697, introduced by Illinois Republican Peter Roskam, had 91 co-sponsors recently and has more now, I believe, about two-thirds of them Republicans. The bill opposes the creation of a database of Israeli settlement companies by the UN Human Rights Council and any efforts to boycott these companies' products. According to Cardin and other original sponsors of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, The bill also seeks to prevent the implementation of similar blacklists or boycotts in the future. It aims to do so in a heavy-handed manner by imposing governmental sanctions, denial of loans, fines, and even potentially jail time on companies complying with calls from the UN Human Rights Council to boycott Israeli settlement products. If it becomes law, the bill could also sweep up in its broad ambit companies refusing to do business with Israeli settlements, whatever their source of inspiration for doing may be. These sanctions would also apply to potential future international governmental calls for a broader boycott of Israel. And there's more on that. Well, I'll read a bit more from that Electronic Intifada article. The draconian nature of the bill is shrewdly shrouded. None of the above-mentioned sanctions are specified in the actual text of the bill. Only by closely examining the underlying laws which would be amended by this bill does its intent become evident to harshly punish those companies which exercise their First Amendment-protected right to engage in boycotts of Israeli settlement products. And it does this by amending two laws, the Export Administration Act of 79 and the Export-Import Bank Act of 1945, to accomplish its aim. Now, I want to skip to an article by Glenn Greenwald and Ryan Grimm on the same subject. They write, "The criminalization of political speech and activism against Israel has become one of the gravest threats to free speech in the West. In France, activists have been arrested and prosecuted for wearing T-shirts advocating a boycott of Israel. The UK has enacted a series of measures designed to outlaw such activism. In the U.S., governors compete with one another over who can implement the most extreme regulations to bar businesses from participating in any boycotts aimed even at Israeli settlements, which the world regards as illegal. On U.S. campuses, punishment of pro-Palestinian students for expressing criticisms of Israel is so commonplace that the Center for Constitutional Rights refers to it as the Palestine exception to free speech. But now, a group of 43 senators, 29 Republicans, and 14 Democrats wants to implement a law that would make it a felony for Americans to support the international boycott against Israel, which was launched in protest of that country's decades-old occupation of Palestine. The two primary sponsors of the bill are Democrat Ben Cardin of Maryland and Republican Rob Portman of Ohio. Perhaps the most shocking aspect is the punishment. Anyone guilty of violating the prohibitions will face a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison." Quoting the ACLU about this, violations would be subject to a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. "We take no position for or against the effort to boycott Israel or any foreign country for that matter. However, we do assert that the government cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, punish U.S. persons based solely on their expressed political beliefs." End quote. Now, speaking for myself, this certainly includes the KBOO Foundation and myself. I am enthusiastically in favor of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I think it's the way to go. I am, as a person of distantly Jewish extraction, I'm rather embarrassed to think that Israel acts in such a grossly racist way, such a hypocritical way towards the Palestinian population, particularly in Gaza. And I think BDS is the way to go, and I'm not going to shut up about it. So, Senator Ron Wyden, I hope you're paying attention, because I certainly expect you to call for enforcement on me first. Please arrest Teresa Mitchell first if this law passes. Yes, I'm furious. And I'm not going to shut up about boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Returning to Glenn Greenwald and Ryan Grimm, this pernicious bill highlights many vital yet typically ignored dynamics in Washington. First, journalists love to lament the lack of bipartisanship in Washington. Yet the very mention of the word Israel causes most members of both parties to quickly snap into line in a show of unanimity that would make the regime of North Korea blush with envy. And Greenwald and Grimm write, "Even when virtually the entire world condemns Israeli aggression or declares settlements illegal, the U.S. Congress, across party and ideological lines, finds virtually complete harmony in uniting against the world consistency and in defense of the Israeli government. Second, the free speech debate in the U.S. is incredibly selective and warped. Pundits and political officials love to crusade as free speech champions when doing so involves defending mainstream ideas or attacking marginalized, powerless groups such as minority college students. But when it comes to one of the most systemic, powerful, and dangerous assaults on free speech in the U.S. and the West generally, the growing attempt to literally criminalize speech and activism aimed at the Israeli government's occupation, these free speech warriors typically fall silent. Third, AIPAC continues to be, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, continues to be one of the most powerful and pernicious lobbying forces in the country. In what conceivable sense, they write, is it of benefit to Americans to turn them into felons for the crime of engaging in political activism in protest of a foreign nation's government? And this is hardly the first time they have attempted to do this through their most devoted congressional loyalists. Cardin, for instance, had previously succeeded in inserting into trade bills provisions that would disfavor anyone who supports a boycott of Israel. And speaking for myself, I have over the years often criticized Ron Wyden as Senator Ron Wyden R. Israel for his consistency in this regard. But returning to the article, finally, it is hard to put into words the irony of watching many of the most celebrated and beloved congressional leaders of the anti-authoritarian resistance, Gillibrand, Schiff, Swalwell, and Liu, sponsor one of the most oppressive and authoritarian bills to appear in Congress in many years. How can one credibly inveigh against authoritarianism while sponsoring a bill that dictates to American citizens what political views they are and are not allowed to espouse under threat of criminal prosecution? Whatever labels one might want to apply to the sponsors of this bill, anti-authoritarianism should not be among them. So you can find that article at TheIntercept.org, TheIntercept.org. And just adding on to that, there's an article by Michael Buchert in JacobinMag.org, and he writes, with the mobile application and online platform act.il, Israel aims to recruit a mob of slacktivists and trolls to join their war against the most insidious forms of violence, pro-Palestinian tweets and Facebook posts. Users of the app are presented with quick daily missions that they complete for points, earning their way up the leaderboards. Missions include liking and commenting on specific Facebook posts, retweeting pro-Israel accounts, and signing petitions. It provides users with suggested comments that they can copy and paste to spam discussion boards and satirical videos and cartoons that are shareable if cringeworthy. In this way, the app identifies and directs users en masse to engage in propaganda online, both affirming pro-Israel sentiment and revealing the supposedly terrorist character of boycott, divestment, and sanction, inciting, and that's with air quotes, content is identified with the help of the Israeli Defense Forces and the Shin Bet, revealing the close collaboration with Israel's military and security forces, but users can also suggest specific posts to be targeted. With this technology, Israel is given the power to actively manage online discourse, taking direct command of its army of volunteer internet warriors and deploying them wherever it is seen fit. It is Israel's friends, however, a diverse network of non-state actors willing to collaborate to advance the state's goals who make this possible. The act.il app is a product of deliberate efforts by the Israeli state in collaboration with universities, American nonprofits, and Israel's tech sector to develop an infrastructure for incubating anti-boycott, divestment, and sanction technologies. One feature in recent years has been the rise of anti-BDS hackathons, multi-day events, which tend to be hosted by Israeli universities in conjunction with pro-Israel think tanks and advocacy groups such as the Root Institute and Stand With Us. These are competitive events with significant cash prizes in which Israeli and international teams of high school and college students meet to develop new algorithms and applications with the intent of identifying and responding to anti-Israel content on social media more efficiently. So there's that. And if you say something, for example, what I was just talking about, there's a possibility that you will be trolled by someone who's actually collaborating with a foreign government. And once again, Senator Ron Wyden is very much behind this bill that I've spoken of. Now, let me see if I can find the number of the bill again. Senate bill, I think it was 720. Well, by golly, that number's not jumping out at me. Anyway, it's the Anti-Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. Yes, it is. Senate Bill 720, or H.R. 1697. And I am calling on Senator Wyden to please arrest me if the bill passes, because certainly I will be guilty of speaking my mind about this. And actually, what I'm saying, of course, is that this is intolerable, and Wyden should be having no part of it, no matter how enthusiastic he is about the state that did not elect him, Israel. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Fracking can contaminate rivers and lakes with radioactive material. Vast amounts of wastewater produced by fracking can contaminate rivers, lakes, and other waterways with radioactive material and hormone-affecting chemicals, according to new research. This was on Reddit Science. The study tested sediments and groundwater downstream of the treatment plant in Pennsylvania that was designed to make the water used as part of the fracking process fit for release into the environment. The scientists from Pennsylvania State University and other academic institutions discovered that despite this process, there are high loads of chloride, barium, strontium, radium, and organic compounds in the Conemaugh River watershed. Stream sediments in Blacklick Creek just downstream from one treatment plant were found to contain about 200 times the level of radium upstream of the plant. The highest concentration of radium was found just 14% below the level at which it would have to be treated as radioactive waste in some U.S. states. However, the researchers said the risks of the pollutants discovered were difficult to assess. Writing in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, the scientists said large quantities of oil and gas wastewater with high loads of chlorium, barium, strontium, radium, and organic compounds have been discharged into the Conemaugh River watershed, stream sediments, and Blacklick Creek. That's just repeating what I just said. But skipping ahead, despite several other sources of contaminants such as coal bed methane, coal mine drainage, and flue gas desulfurization releases that can impact surface water quality, we document multiple lines of evidence that indicate the legacy of unconventional oil and gas wastewater disposal impacting stream sediments and pore water, that is groundwater, on a watershed scale. And when I read these words, I am very much in mind of the more than 500 millisieverts, a very high amount of radioactivity that I've just stumbled upon on a hunch on the rail line just outside of the storage facility in North Portland for fracked oil. And I want to bring up the fact that radium is becoming increasingly a problem in the United States in various places, contamination from radium and other radioactive substances because of fracking. The stuff that is being brought up is just quite radioactive. That's true of Bakken oil as well as Pennsylvania oil. Pardon me. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Now turning to science news, a California biotech firm called Zymergen is one of several efforts to augment or even replace the role of humans in the scientific process. Zymergen tunes up industrial microbes that produce ingredients for biofuels, plastics, or drugs. Seeking to boost production, companies send their workhorse strains to Zymergen. The robots then explore and tinker with each microbe's genome in a bid to engineer a version that makes its product compound more efficiently. Artificial intelligence controls the process, interpreting data, generating hypotheses, and planning experiments. The ultimate goal, says one official, is to get rid of human intuition. That's a quote, to get rid of human intuition. In a Google machine translation from a Chinese website, cnbeta.com, this translation is a bit clumsy, but in a biotech company, Zymergen, an organism controlled by artificial intelligence, is being made to explore the production of more chemical substances. And these robots work for Zymergen, which moved to a factory that was originally for electronics in San Francisco in 2014. These robots are conducting microbiological experiments all day and looking for ways to increase the yield of useful chemicals. The robot is called Echo. It's located in a pile of messy equipment in the middle. A robot arm is present to seize a plastic module. The module has hundreds of fine pores which hold the liquid. A laser scans a barcode next to the module and then it echoes it onto a tray. The next step in the process is difficult to observe with the naked eye. It's done in a completely different way. The robot does not need to absorb it with a pipette and inject a few milliliters of liquid into each well. On the contrary, a bunch of acoustic pulses will cause the liquid itself to ripple at a frequency of 500 times per second and form droplets that are 1,000 times smaller. And it goes on to say that this machine and its artificial intelligence can conduct up to 1,000 experiments per week, whereas a breakneck pace before was maybe 10 hypotheses could be tested every month. So this will greatly speed up genetic engineering. And gist of the article also was that this sort of control of artificial intelligence is becoming more common in industrial processes across the world. Time is 9:28. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. At 10, we're going to hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, we'll have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 11, Between the Covers, Jake Vermas welcomes Portland author Omar El-Akkad and his new novel, American War, a story that asks what might happen if America were to turn its deadliest weapons against itself in a second civil war. Thank you for your generous support if you are a KBOO member. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. I think that's Radio Havana sounding off there. Yep, definitely Radio Havana. And from Radio Havana, the Venezuelan Foreign Ministry has rejected the U.S. government's unbelievable comments on Venezuela that show its absolute bias towards the violent and extremist sectors of Venezuelan politics, which favor the use of terrorism to overthrow a popular and democratic government. The ministry was referring to a statement issued by President Ronald Rump, who said that if the Maduro regime imposes its constituent assembly on July 30th, the United States will take strong and swift economic actions. Trump's threats were repeated by U.S. State Department, which released a statement calling on the government of Venezuela to abandon the proposed National Constituent Assembly. The thin democratic veil of the Venezuelan opposition has fallen, and it reveals the brutal interventionist force of the U.S. government, which has been behind the violence suffered by the Venezuelan people over the last 4 months. It is not the first time that we denounce and confront threats as ludicrous as those contained in this unbelievable document. That's a quote from the Foreign Ministry of Venezuela. They also called on the people of the world to defend sovereignty, self-determination, and independence. Quoting again, the National Constituent Assembly will be elected by the direct, universal, and secret ballot of all Venezuelans under the authority of the National Electoral Council as contemplated in our legal framework. It is an act of political sovereignty of the Republic. Nothing and no one can stop it. The Constituent Assembly will go on. End quote. The threats come after record high numbers turned out to participate in the historic dry run vote for the ANC, which is aimed at easing tensions and creating a more representative constitution. Despite the mass show of public support, the event was largely ignored, as international leaders continue to criticize the Venezuelan government and demand immediate elections. White House spokesman Sean Spicer called on Miraflores to cancel the National Constituent Assembly. That's what I was referring to as ANC.